Now, back to Vocal Point with your host, Jerry Newcomb, on GraceNetRadio.com.
All right, let's see if this works here. Hello, Adam.
I'm here.
Ah, fantastic. Okay, Adam Savitt, production manager for the Center for Security Policy, which is more than just a think tank in Washington, D.C. I remember you all are on Pennsylvania Avenue. And what
That's
exactly
correct.
Is the Center for Security Policy?
Well, our basic motto is peace through strength. And what we do is support policies that strengthen the United States abroad, enhance our national security. And one of our programs is to combat Sharia law, which is a nonviolent form of jihad, which not many people in D.C. are working on. And, of course, the current regime in power doesn't really believe in. So that is our unique mission.
Huh. Okay, what is Sharia law? And by the way, for lack of a better term, the overall title of this show, if you will, is How Do You Solve a Problem Like Sharia? That's not original, but go ahead.
Sure. Well, I'd say the number one way you solve the problem is identifying it. And that is the number one problem we have here in D.C. is that people are afraid to identify the problem. And unless you identify the threat doctrine, of course, how can you hope to combat it?
Sure.
But just the basics on Sharia, though, Sharia is based on the Quran, which is the received words to the Prophet Muhammad, as well as the Hadiths, which are the sayings of Muhammad as recorded by his contemporaries. It's a totalitarian system. It governs every aspect of Islamic life, and by definition, it cannot coexist with our Constitution. That's because the Constitution is a man-made law. Their only authority is the Quran, therefore, Constitution out the window. Sharia sees the world in two distinct ways. Number one, Dar al-Islam, the House of Islam. That's where Islam is dominant, and Sharia is enforced both on Muslims and non-Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Dar al-Harb, the House of War, and that's where fighting is permitted against the infidel. They are required to spread the House of Islam into the House of War, until the entire world is the House of Islam.
Now, if I'm correct, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, it's my understanding that when it comes to violent Muslims killing other human beings, that more actually happens of Muslims killing Muslims because, the number one, they're the ones close to them, but number two, they perceive these other Muslims as not being faithful and devout as Muslims. So it's almost like if you have an active Muslim killing a nominal Muslim, but that just the sheer numbers of dead corpses, that's more than Christians, more than Jews, and more than just secular people that have no religious identification, more than Hindus, etc.
That is absolutely correct. And as you point out, the main reason is those are the people closest who they can attack. And it seems that within Islam, it just inevitably happens that, yes, there are different levels, different strata. Let's take Egypt. That's somewhere where our eyes are on. So you have
sure.
the Christians who are the most oppressed. But yes, they're only 10%, so they're not the main casualties. Then you have the seculars in Egypt. Then you have the Muslim Brotherhood, which, of course, the current President Morsi belongs to, and which is what we would consider an extremist organization. However, there is an organization even more extreme than them, which are called generally the Salafists. And yes, those Salafists can consider the Muslim Brotherhood to be infidels. So yeah, you have many levels of, let's say, increasing extremism, and those extremists see the other Muslims as infidels, therefore as a legitimate target as Christians or Jews, absolutely.
Well, this is like with, you know, the bad times, let's say, during medieval Europe, where sometimes you had Christians, quote-unquote, killing other human beings whom they labeled as heretics, and then, you know, history would show, well, wait a minute, those were actually dissenting Christians that you just killed in the name of Christ, which is totally antithetical to Jesus Christ. But that's interesting. So sometimes Muslims will view their fellow Muslims as infidels because they're not devout enough, or they don't dot the right I's or dash the right T's.
Absolutely. And well, to go to the Christian comparison, the important thing here is ideology. And as you state, at the core of Christianity is tolerance, is love of the fellow man, is, you know, don't inject yourself into politics or violence. Let the secular forces deal with that. But in Islam, Sharia is specifically political. It does command conquest. It does command violence. And therefore, you can say a Christian is improperly interpreting mm-hmm. his violence. However, a Muslim, unfortunately, is interpreting correctly.
All right. Now, as far as Sharia, is it possible that a devout Muslim could be still a good citizen of the United States and he is or she is faithfully following Sharia for them? In other words, Sharia, you know, says this is how I'm going to bathe, this is how I'm going to treat my neighbor, etc.
That's right. You absolutely can, and that's because, especially in the United States, it comes down to individual liberty. It comes down to individual choice. And if a man says, I'm a Muslim, I'm following my faith as I understand it, the most prominent one is Zudi Jasser, who's an absolute hero, doctor out of Arizona, who's outspoken on this, and he believes he's a committed Muslim as well as a tolerant and proud American citizen. The problem is the majority see Sharia in the way I'm describing it, and that is borne out by their actions, by their pattern of voting, by the way they construct society. And so, unfortunately, the violent and the supremacist form of Sharia is ascendant. Now, we can argue on whether that is the correct form as far as the Quran, letter by letter. The problem is the average Muslim sees it that way.
All right. How do you feel the United States is handling the issue of Sharia? For example, you mentioned Dr. Jasser. Well, we interviewed him for our ministry, Truth in Action Ministries, and he said, look, I'm a medical doctor. I have to do diagnoses. If the diagnosis is wrong, then it's bogus. He said when the Defense Department did an 86 whatever it was, page report on the Fort Hood shooter who was yelling out Allahu Akbar, and they never mentioned Islam, they never mentioned the Quranic motivation of the shootings, they totally missed the mark, and the diagnosis is bad, and we can't treat the problem. We're just chasing our tails.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true, and it comes down to the ideology of our elites, which is political correctness above fact. These facts are obvious. The Fort Hood shooter was wearing a traditional Islamic garb. He shouted Allahu Akbar.
Which means Allah is the greatest.
Correct. And this is shouted across the world. You'll hear this for the Syrian rebels.
Yep.
You'll hear this in Egypt. This is accompanying gunfire usually. And that was the case in Fort Hood. And unfortunately, the military elites who seem to become politicians at that level are enforcing political correctness above the facts and above the protection of American citizens and soldiers. And that goes for the foreign policy as well, where the Obama administration is empowering the Muslim Brotherhood forces against all logic, against what they say about their supremacist positions. And if somehow, as the administration official James Clapper said, it's somehow a tolerant secular organization. I don't know where he's getting that information.
He said that about the Muslim Brotherhood?
Correct.
That's outrageous. What do they say? The Quran is our foundation or our constitution. Jihad is our way. Dying for the sake of Allah is the highest glory, etc.
That's correct. Everything they are is religious and violent. Yet there are secular peaceful organizations. It's amazing. And, of course, reality comes back to bite you. Reality comes back in the fact that Mr. President Morsi in Egypt is seizing power, as we knew he would, and is enforcing Sharia from the top down.
Yeah. And look at, by the way, before I leave the subject of the Fort Hood shooting, there are real live implications for this. Not only, number one, does it help open the door potentially for another such attack, because this man was promoted despite his jihadist type, declarations in public.
Okay.
So
he
was a man that should have not been promoted and should have been watched, but instead he was free to do what he did. He killed more than 10 human beings. Those army people are not heroes. They're just the victims of workplace workplace violence. That's outrageous, as opposed to they're dead because they were infidels.
That's right. And that is,
and they lose benefits.
That's right. It's due again to either willful blindness or it's hard to know what the cause is, but the effect, it's mainly political correctness. That's what it is, because not only was he not fired, he was promoted, and it's a form sort of affirmative action in that they were afraid to criticize him because he was a minority, but also specifically because Muslims are perceived as being a threat. Somehow then we have to go out of our way to feel, to present that they're not a threat. And so one thing on his business card, it said he was a soldier of Allah. He gave slideshow presentations where he praised Al-Qaeda and other violent terrorists. It's a self-enforced blindness. And let me insert a word that your listeners may or may not be familiar with, which is dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I. And that is the status of minorities, Christians and Jews, under Islam. And, for example, they can't build churches. They can't walk on the same side of the street. They are second-class citizens. And part of that is you must not insult Islam. You must not commit blasphemy. And in effect, through our own political correctness, we are becoming dhimmi. Without the force of arms, simply through the force of our own misperception of the situation and basically our own timidness about the threat. And yes, it's horrible. It's a backwards world.
Would you say that in some ways being in the dhimmi status would be akin to, let's say, being black in the Jim Crow law days in the South?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Although in some ways it's worse in that in the American system, at least those people were able to rise themselves out of that. And there were facets of the American system, such as our Constitution, that did grant equal rights that we could stand on and eventually get those people out of it.
Right.
The foundational document being the Quran has no such clauses in there. It is eternal.
Yeah, well, as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, America's problem isn't with its creed, that all men are created equal. It's the fact that we're not living up to the creed. So that's the difference.
Right.
What is your website for more information at the Center for Security Policy, Adam?
You can go to securefreedom.org.
Securefreedom.org. And you all put together a wonderful book on the whole issue of Sharia. What was that called?
That was called Sharia Threat to America. So you can Google that. As well, we have a 10-part video course, which I recommend to everyone, very detailed, very referenced. It's called Muslim Brotherhood in America. That's mbinamerica.com, or you can Google it.
All right, sir. Thank you so much. Keep up the great fight, Adam. Okay, bye-bye
Thank you, Jerry.
All right, that's Adam Savitt, production manager at the Center for Security Policy. And we will continue with this theme of Sharia. In fact, we're going to be talking with a medical doctor who has begun writing incredible books on the subject of Islam. His name is Dr. Andrew Bostom, and I'm holding in my hands this huge book called Sharia versus Freedom, The Legacy of Islamic Totalitarianism. Again, his name is Andrew Bostom. The foreword here is by Andrew McCarthy. I had the privilege about a year and a half ago to interview McCarthy. McCarthy was not only an author, I think, I forgot the name of his book. Oh, The Last Jihad, The Great Jihad. The Grand Jihad is what it was called. But he put away the blind sheikh. So he served as a prosecutor in the 1990s and was successful in prosecuting those who were behind the first attack on the World Trade Center. Of course, they came back after that attack in 1993. They came back in 2001 and finished the job. Dr. Bostom, as I understand it, was awakened to the threat of Islam on 9/11. Dr. Bostom, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jerry.
Sure. Now, you have written a few books since 9/11. Why don't you go ahead and just talk about your own personal background and where Islam fits in?
I was very almost entirely absorbed in my academic medical career at the time of 9/11. My wife was actually pregnant with our second child at the time, and she saw the second plane hit the second tower, called me immediately, and that's really where everything got started, frankly. I mean, I picked up a couple of books on Islam. We were wired that night. We grew up in New York originally and emigrated. We did our residencies up in Rhode Island and wound up staying here. I was just reading to her after we accounted for everyone in New York, I was just reading to her from what I later learned to be a very apologetic work by Karen Armstrong, who's a notorious apologist.
Yeah.
And,
for Islam.
For Islam.
Yeah,
exactly.
Former Anglican nun, and she's totally gone off the deep end as far as my perspective. But go ahead.
Well, I think it was her little mini biography of Muhammad, and you know, my wife is a very astute woman, not particularly versed in the subject, but I was reading passages from this apologetic, and she started laughing, and I said, well, you know, honey, this is the same prattle that we're hearing on the television screen, and I don't think it's very funny. There's a disconnect, and really, it was that inspiration that led me to make use of the vast resources at Brown University, where I taught in the medical school and where, you know, residents trained, and I returned to the campus basically for the, you know, other than teaching at the medical school, and began to just, you know, pour through the library. I had a couple of good mentors who are independent scholars who helped a great deal at the beginning, and one of them encouraged me to put together my first book, which was The Legacy of Jihad. And that's really where it all began.
Well, this book is tremendous. If for nothing else, just all the quotes in it. There's more than 700 pages with a complete index. But you open up, for example, with a lot of quotes, including one of my favorites from George Washington. I know he wrote one of the synagogues. I think it was the one in Savannah, Georgia, where he says this. Happily.
No, it's actually, Jerry, it's here. It's
oh,
here.
It's in Truro? Oh, it's the Truro one.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Newport.
You can still, as a matter of fact, my son just took a school field trip there yesterday, and you can see the letter, which has been preserved, you know, at least a replication of it has been preserved.
Well, here's what George Washington said, okay, and this is fantastic. Happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving it on all occasions their effectual support. Now, you go on, you have all these different quotes from all kinds of different scholars on the subject of how Sharia and such tolerance, you know, are not coexistent.
Oh, they're antithetical. I mean, and that really is the theme of the book. And I found it striking. You could juxtapose what was happening in the United States, and particularly at its founding. I mean, very strong Judeo-Christian roots, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And at the same time, I just pointed out to my son when he went to Truro the other day, in my second book, which was The Legacy of Islamic Anti-Semitism, at exactly this same period, so it actually lasted for a couple of years, 1790 to 1792, the Jews of Morocco were under a horrible reign of persecution, violent, Sharia-based persecution, at exactly the same time that this was going on. And this kind of juxtaposition, people are other than super specialized scholars, are absolutely clueless about. You know, there's a broader understanding of, you know, the persecution that Jews experienced in Western Europe, but there's absolutely no understanding of the grinding persecution that they faced under Islam. And I found it striking that Washington, at a time where you know, America wore its Christianity on its sleeve, could utter and really abide by such words at precisely the same time the Jews were under this, you know, grinding persecution which comes directly out of the Sharia.
Right. That's a good point. And by the way, there you are in the state of Roger Williams. Roger Williams was, of course, the Puritan who was in some ways shunned by fellow Puritans, but I think he essentially out-Puritaned the other Puritans, and he was the first to allow freedom of conscience, you know, for all people, including Jews. But let's focus on the subject of Sharia itself, Sharia versus freedom. You basically maintain in this book that Sharia and freedom, let's say Sharia and the U.S. Constitution, they're incompatible.